This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Pre-gens for a scary house.
Mad desire for written symbols.
Manuscript parchment DNA.
And the Cadaver Synod.
Big news from Mission Control. If you missed out the first time, don't panic. The wait is over. The Catstronauts board game is finally back in stock at Atlas Games.
That's right. Catstronauts sold out almost immediately on release, but the reprint has officially landed. Now you can finally bring the kitty crew home to your tabletop.
And just in time, too, because things are getting interesting on the International Space Station.
Giant laser pointers in space and a live stream of nose boops? What's not to like? Let's check out how the Catstronauts are doing up there.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Careful, Waffles. If the other Catstronauts catch you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, it's back to litter box duty for you.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady. Pom Pom is swatting at fasteners like feather toys. And Major Meowser is... napping on the instructions.
Teamwork at its finest. You can lead this kitty crew yourself in the official Catstronauts board game.
It's a cooperative challenge featuring pawsome art by the comics creator Drew Brockington, and it's perfect for gamers of all ages.
But remember, the first printing disappeared at light speed. Don't let this reprint of Catstronauts slip through your claws.
Secure your copy today at atlas-games.com/catstronauts. That's atlas-games.com/catstronauts. The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more into the gaming hut. And today in the gaming hut, the dice we're rattling are a single die six because we're talking Trail of Cthulhu. And as we discussed in 701, we talked about pre-generated characters. Well, it's time for us to pre-generate some characters. And Robin, I understand that the scenario is that most original and inventive of scenarios, your uncle has left you an old house in the terrible woods. I'm excited to see where it goes.
Right. For example purposes only, right? Right. We're going for the most obvious idea because we want to focus just on demonstrating in specific how you would do the thing we talked about in general in 701, which was how to create pregens that hook into the scenario. So let's pick the most obviously accessible adventure hook. Although, you know, the dark old houses can be somewhat of a challenge in Gumshoe because you generally want to go to from different location to different location, but you can certainly start at a dark old house. And I guess before we go on to hook the pre-gens into it, let's figure out what it is that they're going to be hooking into. The house is just the beginning. Which eldritch entity or plot or antagonist do you want to put in or near or under the house, Ken?
All right. If it's a dark house in the terrible woods, then I think that the antagonist should either be a spawn of Shub-Niggurath, right? They got them out in the woods. It's a woods creature. Or we can go Whisper in the Darkness, which is in fact about an old house in the terrible woods in Vermont. And then the bad guys are the Migo, who are also in the terrible woods, the mountains or the hills behind the terrible woods doing their mining. And the house on the terrible woods is as close to the Migo as anyone has ever settled in this particular stretch of Vermont or Minnesota or whichever terrible woods these are.
Right. Well, let's combine them and say that the Migo have come to perform a gruesome experiment on the spawn of Shub-Niggurath.
Right.
So what sort of problem are they going to be causing for people who go there? Is there something that they're doing other than just killing anyone who comes near their experiment. That's clear enough. But is that enough of a story hook to hook the characters into?
I think that the Mego, they know what happens if you dissect a spawn of Shrubnik Earth. They've probably done it 8 million times. So there has to be something specific about this location nearby. It's some sort of a vortex. Maybe there's time unbinding possibilities in it. And so they're thinking maybe we can sacrifice this spawn once and it will count as an infinity of sacrifice. And so we'll open up a magical vent here at this specific spot of time unbinding. And the trouble is that once they start, drilling their sounding holes for their time unbinding vent, then time unbinds in the house as well. And so the dead, many of whom probably worshipped Shub-Niggurath because they lived in this horrible old house, they're starting to wake up and they're probably not happy that the Mego are trying to blasphemously tap their mistress's spawn for occult energies. And so I think that, the other thing is that the Mego know that they need fresh human blood for the sacrifice. They don't need a ton of it, but it's probably best if, some number of humans, let's say 2 or 3, are around so that they can be bled into the sacrifice for all time and thus sort of seal the little spark gap across the time vent that they're about to open up.
So has the uncle been working against the cult of Shub-Niggurath, or is the uncle maybe not even dead and luring the sacrifice victims that the cult needs and that the Mego are going to appropriate?
I think maybe he was dead and he's been not so much reanimated, but reprojected by the time field beginning to come loose. And so you could either play it where when he was living in the house, of course, he consorted with Shub-Niggurath and used her powers and was a typical old wizard living in the woods type guy. But now that he's come back, he knows that he has to sort of break that connection because he's one of the connectors that's keeping this time loop open. So he could have had a face turn when he died and came back to life and recognized that his nephew or niece, whoever it is being drawn into this thing himself. Or he could still be awful and say, well, if it's my blood they want, I'll just swap it out and then I can possess the body of my nephew or niece. And now you've got 3 enemies. You've got the spawn who's just mad at everything. You've got the Mego who are trying their experiment, and you've got the uncle who is trying to sort of swap out his role in the experiment and let someone else stay and be the time anchor, and he can wander back out in a fresh new body, which it's probably better for his magic if it's the body of his kin, but doesn't have to be, especially as time keeps unbinding and people's common ancestors going far enough back become accessible to him. So that's a possibility.
Right. So we've got lots of stuff going on for a one shot, all sorts of possibilities, possibly a 3-way confrontation at the end or 4-way once you factor in the player characters. So I've taken the liberty of choosing some Trail of Cthulhu occupations and attaching names, but nothing else to them. So who do you think is the niece or nephew? Is it the alienist, the antiquarian, the archaeologist, the cowhand, the dilettante, or the ex-military nurse?
I feel like if your uncle got property out in the forest, that implies that maybe you're well off. So maybe the dilettante is the heir, but I could also see a possibility of it being the antiquarian who's the heir because the uncle knew that to lure them up into the practice of Shub-Niggurath, which is what they thought they were doing to begin with, they needed to sort of play on their niece's love of antiques, which of course, as an old house that's been here since settlement times, this place is full of.
Well, let's make it the antiquarian because the dilettante is always easy to motivate because he's,
right,
a perpetual tag along and we can make his hook the relationship to the other character. So
right.
Faye Gallatin, the antiquarian, on her character sheet, it says, this is your uncle. You've inherited this old house and probably includes a detail about the uncle that suggests that the reason you haven't been in touch with him lately is that he was estranged from the family. There were shadowy rumors. And I guess because you're an antiquarian, you know that he had some pretty good old books and antiques and stuff. And that's your motivation to go there, because if we're actually going to run this as one shot, all the players are going to, oh no, the old house. Why the old house? So we have to give a really strong reason
right.
for at least one of the characters to go to the house. So let's then look at the alienist, Lionel Chan. What is it about Lionel that is going to hook specifically into this adventure? Either the cult, the time loop, the Mego. What are we going to put in his little super short bio that gives him a thing to do and pursue in the course of the one shot?
I like the idea that Lionel can be where we introduce the time unbinding, and that Lionel, you know, woke up one day and he discovered that he has had Faye Gallatin as maybe a patient, and he's got whole books on her case. And the notion being that, you know, in a slightly different timeline, she was his patient, and so it slipped over, or that his character in the future will recognize that he needs to have access to this group. And so he has sort of in the past gone and made her his client. So he shows up, and he can be another mystery, and he's a signpost of the mystery. And Faye Gallatin says, I've never met you before in my life. And he says, oh yeah, what about your dreams about grasshoppers? And she says, oh my God, how did you know? And he says, because you have told me about them. You just don't remember it. What's this about? And then that can set up the time loop situation, or the time rift situation.
So next we come to Anton Romero. He's the archaeologist. And so the obvious hook here is that he suspects there is some sort of site there, because if this is an area that is sufficiently numinous to have had time slip possibilities and a current cult and attracting the Mego, there will be other relics from even more archaic times when either Shub-Niggurath was active, probably, or he may have, well, since we want the time slip to figure into this, let's say that people have shown up at his offices with some strange artifacts that, you know, have just fallen through time, and they swear that they found, you know, these artifacts which they think are Roman, but maybe they're Lemurian. And so Anton has to look up his contacts, and he remembers, oh wait, I think Faye said something about inheriting land in the area. It's my chance to go along. So this gives him a reason to be there, gives him an additional mystery, gives him a clue into the mystery, which is very important in a one shot, because it gets the story started right at the beginning. You already know something to pursue, and also possibly a hidden agenda. Maybe he hasn't quite revealed to everybody, you know, don't tell anybody why you're really there, but you're looking for these artifacts.
Right.
That's an action, and it's a little bit of mild conflict within the group.
And the archaeological site from Lemurians or Lomarians or whoever it was is something that, you know, he begins to think might be, you know, right here on this property. And of course, that's where the time vent is going to be made. So he has reasons to go into the woods behind the house because he's looking for the site.
What about Glenda Usher, our cowhand?
I think Glenda can either be a local from the town, and then it's a sort of a remote rural town. So maybe Glenda is local and is going to be their connection to the people of the town who otherwise would say, ah, you got the old Gallatin place. Well, good luck. You're doomed, or whatever. So Glenda is from the town, and maybe Glenda is independently. Oh, I know what it is. Her uncle died owing Glenda a bunch of money because he's like, ah, whatever. I'm a wizard. I don't have to pay people. And so, you know, she'd cleared all this, you know, land in front of his house, you know, taken out all the trees and whatnot. And he left owing her money. And so she has a reason to come and involve herself and say, oh, you're not going to take any of those valuable artifacts out of this house until I get my money. And then also, however, she can remember what Faye's uncle was up to. She can provide information that way, and she can be a conduit to the town if they really do decide they need to go back in and order like 100 jerry cans of gasoline and a bunch of dynamite, and she would know where to go to get that stuff.
And if she was clearing the land, let's say she's the one who found the artifacts that of possible Lemurian origin that she then went to Anton Romero.
Romero.
And so Anton knows to look her up at the beginning because he's She knows about the place, and she's more capable than all of these academics so far. So that can be a relationship between the characters that also appears on the pre-gen sheet, and the reason that he has asked her to meet the group when they arrive, and that saves the faffing about of how do we get this local character to be on stage right at the beginning, while Anton arranged for her to be waiting for everybody.
Right.
As already alluded to, the dilettante is always easiest. DeWitt Bannister is friends with both Faye and Anton, and has tagged along because an old dark house sounds like a delightful situation to him, and one in which he can possibly escape a scrape in the city involving a gambling debt or perhaps an angry lover. And so he's going to tag along for what he thinks will be a nice little vacation in the woods. So he can be the non-Lovecraftian character who can give the player lots of fun pretending not to understand what's going on and quipping and perhaps entering the time slip and maybe even interacting with some of his dodgier ancestors. So finally, Ken, Monica King, the ex-military nurse.
I feel like Monica and Faye maybe went to college together. And so Faye, I mean, she's not going to go up into these woods all by herself. And she knows that Monica is, you know, reliable in a scrap or capable of, you know, picking up the other end of a Louis the 16th table. And so she just brings Monica out as a friend and says, let's go up to the house. And Monica, being a good friend, is happy to do it. And so maybe Faye brings Monica along to sort of keep DeWitt's intentions honorable, if DeWitt is that kind of dilettante, or maybe Monica is interested in tagging along because of her own interest either in Faye or in Anton. And so it's the sort of classic, why do I let you talk me into this type stuff, as opposed to the, oh, an old dark house, that sounds positively ripping type person.
Right. I'd be a little concerned that somebody's going to X-card DeWitt being sort of a lech.
Right.
But I think the idea that Monica is suspicious of Anton's motives, because she has a cess honesty. She will build that into her character, thinks that there's something funny going on, and that gives her a thing to do, which is be protective of Faye, but also a question to answer, which is, why does Anton's story for wanting to come along not quite stack up?
Right.
So that creates a little bit of inter-party tension and a question to resolve, and therefore a clue that one character can wring out of another character and get Anton to, at some point, confess about the Lemurian artifacts, which, of course, are integral to finding the time slip. So there you go. There's an example of actually doing the thing that we talked about. So we started with the premise, with the plot, what we wanted people to do during the story. And then we found different ways for them all to enter the story and also secondarily to relate to one another. So I think it's time for us to give the opportunity for our beloved listeners to relate to an exciting commercial message, and then come right back for another Hut and/or segment.
I want high fantasy investigative adventure.
But Ken, there's only one of you.
I got you there. You are a GM, Robin.
You do have me there.
And a GM and a player is all you need for Paragon Blade, the gumshoe one-to-one game of swords and spells.
In the Paragon Blade from fantasy master Gareth Ryder Hanrahan, you play a hero in a fantastical land, still scarred by the evil of the fallen hellbound empire.
Mystery and magic collide in tales of conspiratorial wizards, monstrous foes, and arcane intrigue.
Gather your wits, your allies, and your blade.
Three advantages see you through the perils that await.
A trusty companion, a wise mentor, a stalwart servant, or cryptic ally.
A relic from the dark days of old, a treacherous artifact of terrible power.
And most of all, you're a hero of great skill and insight. You'll read the riddle of this broken world and battle evil in all its many forms.
Paragon Blade includes all the rules you need for an intense head-to-head experience in the fantasy vein.
Plus, detailed guidance on building your own heroes and quests.
fits superbly with virtual tabletops.
Comes with three scenarios with the heroes designed to plumb their mysteries.
Barbarian hero Khan the Unslain must race against time to seek a cure for a demonic curse in Heart of the Beast.
Alethea the Scholar must conceal her sorcerer's powers from her father the magistrate while helping him investigate the Isle of Death.
Puck the Thief must steal the Jar of Doom before anyone else opens it.
Paragon Blade, now available at the Palgrain Web Store.
Or at a discerning game retailer near you.
The smell of the bindings, the groaning of the shelves, the clicking of the cursor as we look up our database of books. So we're once more in the book hut. This time around, we're there at the behest of a beloved Patreon backer, Alex Gill, who says, surely one of the best book titles ever, Kitab Shak El Mutahim for Mafarat Ramuz El Aklam, the title translated by Tom Stevenson as The Book of Mad Desire for the Knowledge of Written Symbols. I can find little online on its contents. Did a biography of Ken Haidt somehow appear in Arabic in the 11th century? In which case, how and why?
Fair question. It is not a biography of Ken Haidt, unless I have been much busier in imaginary Egypt than I normally am. The Kitab Shak al-Mustaham fi Mafirat Rumuz al-Aklam is also translated by Wikipedia as the Book of the Desire of the Maddened Lover for the Knowledge of Secret Scripts, somehow even better than Tom Stevenson's translation.
Yeah, that suggests that there's a little shipping going on between the reader and some occult symbols.
Exactly. The first English translation of that title was done by a fellow named Joseph. At the time, he was just simple Joseph Hammer, but eventually became known as Joseph von Hammer Pergstall, and that's more fun, so I'm going to call him that, even though it's anachronistic to this translation. The Long-Desired Knowledge of Occult Alphabets Attained, or by the scholars Isabel Toral Nyhoff and Annette Sundermeyer, whose paper I'm using for most of the rest of this segment, as The Long-Desired Fulfilled Knowledge of Occult Alphabets. So the title's a bit of a sales pitch. It's like, hey, you've always wanted to know about occult alphabets, haven't you? And people would say, I sure have. And you can tell that they did because they kept copying it down. The book is ascribed on the title page to Ibn Washia, an Aramaic-speaking Iraqi alchemist. So one of the natives that was conquered by the Arabs, and he flourished in the early 10th century AD. He dies in 930. He's from a tribe that claimed descent from King Sennacherib. So if he lived in North Chicago, we'd call him an Assyrian today. Most famous for his magico-agricultural work, Nabataean Agriculture. Nabataean not referring to the kingdom of Nabatea down around Petra, but just meaning Syriac, which is to say Aramaic speaking. So it's the magic agriculture of his people. And he's sort of laying it out as a reason that his folks, the Assyrians, the Sennacheribians, the Nabataeans, are cool and have magic knowledge, and maybe you shouldn't persecute them so bad, everybody. So that's his sort of role in the world. It's probably not by him, because none of his crazy obsessions are in the text, which is all about, as I say, Egypt. None of his other writings imply he's ever been to Egypt, and the author of this book claims to have been to Egypt. A different scholar named Jaakko Hamin Antila, a Finnish scholar, I hope, suggests that the true author was Hassan ibn Faraj, who was a copyist of Ibn Washia around 1022 AD, which is why the main volume, the Shak, also has an appendix that is full of the Ibn Washia mythos, these figures of occult lore that turn up in other Ibn Washia books. The sages Sagrith, Yanbushad, and Kuthami. And no one knows anything about them. They only show up in Ibn Washia's books. And so the notion that whoever forged or wrote the appendix was at least familiar with the Ibn Washia legend corpus.
Right. His cinematic universe.
Right. Exactly. And Toral Nyhoff and Sundermeyer, by the way, say that it was an unknown author of the mid to late 9th century. So before Ibn Washia, based on the absence of 10th century Arabic Hermes legendary, because it talks a lot about Hermes, but it doesn't mention the fact that there are three Hermeses, or that Hermes dies and comes back to life two times, which is a big part of his legend after the book is written. So the fact that it's not there makes them think that it's from an older source, and that the copyist just decided to ascribe this old anonymous book to Ibn Washia as a way to sort of sell it, because the Nabataean agriculture was enormous and very popular, and also contained useful hints about agriculture in addition to astrology and magic and other stuff. So I think there was maybe a little bit of, this book is old and wise, it must be Ibn Washia's, because it's about sort of old pagany things, not about good Muslim things.
Right. People always want the magic of cow encouragement.
Right. So the book is not super long. In the typeset version translated by Joseph von Hammer-Purgstall, it's 118 pages of Arabic. That's the shulk. And then this appendix part that has the mythos in it is another 18 pages, again, in 1806 era typesetting. And so that's the appendix is that second manuscript, and we don't know what it's named because it just got schlooped into the main text. So in the main book, there are eight chapters, and the chapters basically each provide various occult alphabets or maybe ciphers. So you'll have the symbol and then it's transliteration into Arabic, so you can, you know, write it out. And the first chapter is Kufic and Maghribi Arabic, in case you're from a part of the Ummah that does not practice either of those scripts, so it lays that out, plus a Hindi treated as a sort of a cipher or a transliteration, so you have the alphabet but no Hindi grammar or anything else. Then we have some more regular alphabets, the Syriac alphabet, the Hebrew alphabet, the Greek alphabet, your standard alphabets. And then chapter 3 is the alphabets of the seven sages, and that's Hermes, Asclepius, Plato, Socrates, those guys. Chapter 4 is the alphabets of 24 less sages, Ptolemy, Dioscorides, something called the red alphabet, which seemed very cool, an alphabet for use on talismans, etc. Chapter 5, the alphabets of the seven planets. Chapter 6, the alphabets of the 12 zodiac signs. Chapter 7, the alphabets of 10 ancient kings. And I just want to say, per the previous speculation by Alex Gill, this does sound like something I would have written as like a young lad. If I'd found a book of alphabets, I absolutely would have transcribed them all into a notebook.
Yeah.
So,
and whoever it was obviously knows how to write back cover cell text.
Yeah.
Because one of the tricks is to have different numbers of different things, which you will absolutely see us do at Pelgrane. Uh-huh. So, you know, a bunch of alphabets of the zodiac, but 12 zodiac signs. 12? That's exactly the number that zodiac. I got to pick this book up. So
24 lesser sages. I only knew 20 lesser sages. This is amazing.
Exactly. Yeah. The BuzzFeed listicle only had 8 lesser sages.
Right. That's nothing. So chapter 7 then is the alphabets of the ancient kings, the kings of Assyria, the Haramisa, which is to say the Hermes kings, the pharaohs, the Canaanites, Chaldeans, Kurds, Chaldeans, Persians, and Copts. And then finally, the sort of pièce de résistance, the alphabets of Hermes the Great and Hermesian priest scholars. And these are divided into symbols for things of heaven, for animals, for plants, and for minerals. And so these are symbols that Hermes Trismegistus, Hermes the Great, would have used back when he was writing, sort of the Ur alphabet of all of it. And then finally, the appendix, as I mentioned, that's not part of the formal shulk, is the Shimshim alphabet of the Hermesian initiates, is what it says, but it's actually hieroglyphs. And finally, we've gotten to hieroglyphs, and it reads them phonetically instead of logographically. And before this, everyone had seen hieroglyphs as symbols. And so lion meant lion, not meant L, for example. And so this is the first example of reading a hieroglyph logographically in the literature. And some people say, well, this proves that the Arabs could read the hieroglyphs. And it's like, it doesn't necessarily prove that at all. I mean, there's no other text that implies that this became part of a broader intellectual current, although I suppose this is your origin story for a sorcerer who takes this book and goes into Egypt and reads the tomb of Nyarlathotep or something, gets up to bad news. And then there's three more alphabets of the ancient Chaldeans just to keep their hand in the appendix. And so that's the book, those 136 pages, I guess. So the book exists now in three known and cataloged copies. These are full copies in Paris, Vienna, and Munich. And there's a copy in Berlin that doesn't have the appendix in it. And there is one that has gotten so far as to have a library entry, but Torl Nyhoff and Sundermeyer haven't double checked. That's supposedly in Cairo. And then there's a rumor of one in Tehran, but no one has obviously seen that in forever.
Right. I like the idea that the one in Berlin is the one where someone went, this appendix is spurious. Rip.
Or better yet, this appendix lets me read the Tomb of Nyarlathotep. Double rip.
Rip. Yeah.
Athanasius Kircher may have seen a copy in Malta in the 17th century because he, of course, is also writing about the hieroglyphs and what could they possibly mean. And at least von Hammer-Purgstall believes that Kircher's allusions pretty much clearly mean he's read this book. But that might be von Hammer-Purgstall doing his own bit of drafting in a famous sage to give his book cred.
Right. And give people a little more to recall about Athanasius Kircher.
Athanasius Kircher is the great polymath. He was the man who wanted to know everything. And a lot of the things he wanted to know were about like the hollow earth and ley lines and magic and alchemy. So he's sort of a all-purpose wisdom guy. And he was trying to fit all the mental universe of the early modern era, which includes, of course, demons and angels and zodiacs and astrology and everything else, into a unified theory, if you will, or a unified whole on the theory that this is how God sees the world. And now that God has given us these natural gifts of natural philosophy, we can see the world this way, too, if we just read enough books, which, you know, Kircher, what a great guy. So anyway, the first translation of this book out of Arabic is into English. It's in 1806 by Joseph von Hammer-Purgstall under the title Ancient Alphabets and Hieroglyphic Characters Explained. And if you or Alex Gill or anyone else wants to read it, that's the title you type into the Internet Archive and you can read it just like I did. And Hammer-Purgstall was very excited about the image of Bahumid, which is one of the glyphs, and it shows sort of a man calf, not a moon calf, but a man calf with a weird sort of a pentagram type thing in front of them. And he says that this Bahumid image is Baphomet, and that obviously this explains what the Templars were up to. And he wrote a very influential article on Baphomet, apparently triggered by him seeing this glyph and being curious. And so he is a mystical Templar guy, and he is also one of the early translators of the Arabian Nights. He went and found manuscripts that were not in the original French translation, the Galland translation, and was trying to build an Arabian Nights while he was alive. And so Hammer-Purgstall is a universal joint in your early 19th century occult investigation, certainly.
So if your character with linguistics then finds a weird alphabet, he can either say, oh, get me my translation of the Ancient Alphabets and Hieroglyphic Characters Explained, and pull that out, and he can point to the page that it's on, or he can exclaim, this alphabet is not even in the Hammer-Purgstall. Clearly, this is an alien tongue unknown to any scholar prior to now. And so either way, that can give you a bit of depth to your linguistics knowledge, because, you know, that's on your character sheet and you hardly ever get to use it. So throw in an alien alphabet to throw those people a bone, GMs.
And the other thing is that these are great alphabets to use if you want to write something in weird characters. It's full of weird characters. You've got 24 lesser sages to ascribe things to, and even an alphabet for them to write them in. And given the Hermesian symbols, these can be symbols of a secret society. So if you want the bad guys to be really into poisonous plants, then they have this weird fan-shaped symbol, and that's their sort of watchword, this cult of poisoners. And then, oh, there's a mandrake symbol that's sort of an upside-down triangle with either four dots or a face in it. That's a good... So if you're looking for a sort of an icon for your cult or your conspiracy or your weird magicians to use, it's full of those. And then also, this is more neat stuff to put in an alchemist's laboratory. An alchemist would definitely have access to this book. If it's a pre-1806 alchemist, then the question is, do they have one of these four copies in Europe, or do they have a fifth copy with maybe an extra alphabet for Aklo or something? And that's the one that you really want to get a second appendix, get your hands on.
Well, I think it's time for us to stop talking about this book and maybe talk about a bunch of books in the next segment.
Play The King in Yellow has haunted imaginations like a dirge since its first appearance in 1895.
But among the fortune tellers of Europe, the play was not the fearful beginning of something new, but the culmination of something older, The King in Yellow Tarot.
Daniel Harms and John Scott Tynes, famous clairvoyants, divined the form's importance of this Carcosan deck.
Painter Kurt Komoda, in a fevered fugue of inspiration, reproduced designs thought long lost.
Spread the cards.
Let the King in Yellow tell your fate.
There is no other who could.
After all, you have seen the yellow sign.
The King in Yellow Tarot is a complete deck of 78 cards in full color.
Sturdy cards with a soothing, silky finish.
Inspired by the works of Robert W. Chambers.
An accompanying 28-page guide explores the history of the deck and recommends, hesitantly, its technique.
A complete PDF of cards and guide comes with your order.
Add to cart at shop.arcdream.com.
That's your reality-shattered cart at shop.arcdream.com.
Fulfill your mad desire for keeping this podcast alive by joining beloved Patreon backers.
Louis Sylvester.
Ludovic Chavant.
Luke Silburn.
Mark Kevin Hall.
And Ross Ireland.
The hiss of the Bunsen burner, the crackling of the Van de Graaff generator, and the of whatever the heck that giant expensive machine in the corner is, welcome us once more into the clean tiled hut that we use to practice fun with science. And today's fun with science, we are apparently, I don't want to get ahead of myself, Robin, but we are possibly making medieval carnivorous sheep because we are extracting animal DNA from medieval manuscript paper. And as you know, Robin, whenever you extract DNA from things, trouble ensues. But why don't you explain what on earth they think they're doing before we get to what can go wrong?
Okay, so recently on your various pop science websites and also some medievalist websites, the story made the rounds, and it comes from a paper published just in May of this year in the journal called Manuscript Studies, which comes out twice a year and I guess is apparently all about manuscripts. Uh-huh. And what has happened is that a team of researchers have invented a new non-destructive technique for testing the DNA in parchment. And then they have taken this and proven it by combining it with the previous accepted technique and studied a whole bunch of parchment manuscripts, 91 of them, in the rare book collection of Duke University. So you can find this paper in academia.edu, or I think this is an open source journal, so you might be able to find the print version as well. And it's under the title Adventures in the Animal Archive, New Techniques for the Genetic Analysis of Parchment Manuscripts. The authors are mostly from North Carolina State University, and the six authors, the first two listed, are Timothy L. Stinson and Melissa Scheibel. And this is a quite readable, accessible paper. It's got a zippy overview of the history of parchment. And they mentioned just how much of it we have from late antiquity to today. It's not just in books. They often find that parchment is stuffed into other things or used as a repair medium. So you might find it in a dress or in a bishop's mitre. So that, I think, has all sorts of different possibilities for clues. Just right there, we can skip the animal DNA bit and go, oh, what if this, you know, spell is in a bishop's hat or is used as dress stuffing? What happens when someone finds one of those? But at any rate, the point they make is that that means that we have kept a vast archive of millions of animal skins preserved as parchment. And that means that there's a field devoted to its study. Possibly the six authors of these are 50% of the people in this field. Yep. But
and they're writing this paper to show up those jerks at North Carolina. Right. NC State is where it's at, guys.
So the field has a fabulous name, which is the most important thing about establishing a new scientific field. It's biocodology.
Ooh.
Of course, the study of the biology of books. And I think we're going to have to use that a whole bunch of times. So what is the non-absurd reason to do this? And if you are testing the DNA, you can, for example, find out if all of the pieces of parchment in a particular book are from one flock of closely genetically related animals, which would mean that they are all sourced in the same place.
Like you were at the monastery and they had a sheepfold and they would make the parchment out of their sheep after they ate them later. And that was just how it worked.
Right. Or if you test the pages in a book and all of them are from relatively unrelated sheep or cows, that means that someone went to the marketplace to buy the animal skins. And possibly that would indicate that the book was sourced from an urban center. And the issue with this is that while natural historians, as a matter of course, will happily take destructive samples of the specimens in their collection, because that's what they're for. Mm-hmm. Right? It's like, well, there's only 12 of these Denisovan teeth in the world. Well, that's all the more reason to drill it. How are we going to find out about Denisovan DNA if we don't drill this tooth? But librarians have a bit of a different attitude toward destructive testing. And it's difficult for scientists who are looking for DNA to convince librarians to let them touch their books at all.
Right.
So there's a whole different ethos there. And so the trick then to sell them on the idea of having their books tested is to promise them that no harm will come to the books. And so there's already an existing test that used a PVC eraser to sort of take eraser shavings and then study those. And those are already used in book conservation. So librarians and rare book collections are cool with those. But this team came up with a second technique. And when I initially looked at this story, I went, this is going to be way too technical. I won't understand it. I won't be able to explain it. But you take a brush and you brush stuff off. And there's where you get your little flakes that you can then use and test. So it's
what if we didn't leave our schmutz everywhere? The central thesis of biocodology.
Yes. And schmutz is left by, you know, not just the animal that the skin came from, but a book, especially a very old book, kind of accumulated all sorts of different DNA over the decades and centuries. So you might find traces of rodents or insects, notable for their own invasive testing on books.
Mm-hmm.
Also viruses, you can find traces of viruses. And one would expect the DNA of the people who handled the parchment or the book. So if someone cut themselves while skinning an animal or poked themselves with their pen while copying a book, there might be a little bit of them left behind. And in tandem with this second new technique for getting DNA from books without harming them, also the quality of DNA testing has advanced in a couple of decades since anyone thought to DNA test a book, where the quality of the sample needed to get useful information is radically lower. So you used to need like a big full sample, and now little traces of stuff will ping with different reliable results. So this team, as I said, tested 91 manuscripts from the Duke U Rare Book Library, and they took a real sort of core sample of different genres, points of origin, languages, and time periods. And
you know that must have annoyed the guys at NC State that they had to go to Duke to get the rare books. They're like, oh, yeah, no, we'll let you non-investigatively test it, but you have to say Blue Devil's Rule. Damn it.
Yes, well, I haven't looked up, you know, how many Necronomicons the North Carolina State has.
Right. Not enough, apparently.
Not enough. And their superstar discovery, the coolest thing they discovered, was a 12th century Gospel of Luke, where the cattle and sheep parchment were interspersed. So there's one sheep, one cattle, one sheep, one cattle. And even better, on the page where it told the story of the prodigal son, where the prodigal is complaining, Dad, you never bought me a baby goat when I was a kid. That one page is goat skin.
Ah, monk jokes. Love it. Yeah.
So I guess we're going to have to rename Easter eggs goat pages. Right. You know, that's a real goat page there.
Yeah.
So that's a deep reference somebody's making. And who would get that?
I guess if you've handled enough parchment, you can sort of recognize it. I guess when it's newish, it probably smells different. It is a bit of a deep cut, even if you are a 12th century monk, I'll bet.
Right. And they also discovered that over different locations, there would be a different distributions of various animals used to create the parchment. So English samples, 80% sheep, 20% cow. West Asia, all sheep. That's all you get. East Africa is 76% goat, 24% sheep. And Europe is nearly even thirds between goat, sheep, and cow. So that gives a very clever thing for your gumshoe character with the document analysis skill to say, which is, this book can't be from West Asia. It's all goatskin. That can't possibly be the case. You know, so it must be a forgery, or it must not be from where they say it is.
Or maybe it's done by goat cultists.
Right. And so the paper even starts to do our work for us here on the podcast by mentioning the possibility of revival of extinct breeds.
See, the simplest attempt to mess around with DNA and someone starts saying, what if we reanimate an aurochs or whatever?
Right. Well, they do have a snappy title, Adventures in the Animal Archive. So Someone there might have handled a polyhedral at some point. That's all I'm saying. So they're, of course, thinking of extinct breeds of sheep or cows. But what if you find the DNA and you go off to the de-extinction company and what you get is from a satyr or a minotaur or a bonicon? There you go. You've got your monster back to life. Or what about the binding of the book? Presumably, they can still get some DNA from the bindings without damaging them unduly. Or in our story, people are not nearly as ethical as this team and might be willing to do some destructive analysis in order to find out that this book, which is said to be bound in dragon skin, is in fact bound in that substance or in the wings of a demon or a Byakki. So essentially, this could get us to... We could do a story of someone trying to make an end run around the dangers of spellcasting by doing a laboratory-based demon summoning, right? You get his DNA.
That's better than the true name.
Implant the DNA in something, and a regular animal is not going to result from that. But a demon, that's all it needs to manifest. And since you didn't exactly call it up, maybe you think, anyway, it's going to be easier to put down. We could also use this as a jumping off point to a techno thriller story where someone is creating a bio weapon from an extinct virus.
Yes. Ancient anthrax.
Possibly the manuscript it's discovered in a monastery that was leveled by plague. And you can avoid the magic, but have the weird science going there. Or possibly, back to magic a bit here, you can have your evil sorcerer want to commune with a particular scribe or copyist, because as we said, people are leaving their blood in the books in little driblets and drablets. And, you know, every so often you just get the animal skinner who's no use to you, but sometimes you'll get the scholar who wrote the book that you're looking for because, you know, what is this new brushing technique finding? But essential salts, right? What are essential salts except for a DNA sample, right? Mm-hmm. So Charles Dexter Ward of our era can use some DNA to whip up the scribe he wants to talk to.
Also, of course, we know that Dracula or any other medieval vampire probably handled some books and might have thought ahead and said, if I drip a little of my blood into this book, then centuries later, someone's going to wake it back up and then I can come back. You know, just like in Taste the Blood of Dracula, Brush the Blood of Dracula, the somewhat less lascivious sequel.
So this is all full of possibilities to have fun with science and fun with books. And if nothing else, we have all learned our favorite new word, biocodology.
Biocodology. And go North Carolina State Wolfpack. And go specifically to our next ad, which is probably relevant to North Carolina and even perhaps to sheep, but we'll find out later. The British are coming.
The Kickstarter campaign is almost upon us for Flag Bearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The next book, The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, follows the actions of the war in the South and the West with historical adventures, setting information, perfidious new enemies, and a sprawling campaign.
The Kickstarter campaign also features a revised core book supporting play in other eras, a supplement about political scheming within the two sides of the war, and years of maps, supplements, splat books, and adventures following the war from Boston to Yorktown.
Nations and Cannons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
This Kickstarter is the best time ever to get into Nations and Cannons.
Sign up to be notified of the Kickstarter campaign at yourdadwilllovethis.com. The whirring of time gears and the clacking of chronotons tell us that we're once more standing in proximity to Ken's time machine, which, of course, is the conveyance that his superiors at Time Incorporated use to send him back into history to bend, fold, spindle, and sometimes, yes, even mutilate it. And sometimes just wondering either whether an incident needs to be messed with, or you will find out that an incident has been messed with by one of your many time rivals and needs to be restored. And so I'm not sure which way you're going to go on this, but I would like to know whether you want to sabotage the Cadaver Synod or restore it after it's sabotaged by others?
Well, that's a good question, Robin. And I think there's no better time agent to send to what even historians of the church call the dark century of the papacy than your Presbyterian time agent. So I'm here prepared to care deeply about the Cadaver Synod of Pope Formosus.
Yes, these are people who never had the chance in regular history to receive Protestant side eye.
So, exactly.
This will be their chance.
Most exciting kind of side eye. Formosus, the cadaver in question, spoiler, he's born near Rome in 816. Apparently rises through the ranks of the church because Pope Nicholas the Great makes him the Cardinal Bishop of Porto, which is Porto being the port of Rome, not Ostia anymore, but Porto. And so that's a good sinecure for a guy. He's the Cardinal Bishop, so he doesn't have to handle, you know, running the church at all. He just is there to be a cardinal. So he's sent to Bulgaria as the papal legate, and Bulgaria at this point is deciding between, do they want to be Catholic or do they want to be Orthodox? Do they want to follow Byzantium or Rome? He's very persuasive and beloved in Bulgaria, and Tsar Boris of Bulgaria says, this guy you've sent is so great, make him my archbishop, and then we'll be Catholic. And apparently, for whatever reason, Pope Nicholas says, I don't think we're going to do that. Sadly, he's already Cardinal Bishop of Porto. You can't switch bishoprics. Good luck, everybody.
And also that might entail actual work, which right. I don't trust him to do.
Yeah. So for whatever reason, Formosus is catching side eye, even from his own patron. In 872, he's a candidate for Pope, but he loses to John the Eighth. And you're thinking, well, he's a candidate for Pope. The guy who became Pope, he's chosen of Christ. He's surely going to be magnanimous. No, he's not. In 875, John the Eighth's candidate for Holy Roman Emperor shows up in Rome to get crowned with a lot of armed soldiers. And Formosus says, I'm going to go do my bishop duties in France, nowhere near my bishopric. And so Pope John VIII excommunicates him for abandoning his see and refusing to stand still to let the Germans kill him. But time comes for all of us, even for Pope John VIII. He goes away. Pope Marinus I is the new pope, and he restores him to Porto. So we have shadows of some sort of papal politics situation going on, and it's sort of hard to tell exactly who's on which side, and also they all switch sides all the time. But for whatever reason, by 891, he is unanimously elected Pope Formosus. So what a great story. And he notices that the guy who's trying to run the Vatican is the Duke of Spoleto, and who have basically talked previous popes into making them Holy Roman Emperor. And Formosus does not want to have someone who's from the next town over as the emperor. That's far too much like paying taxes and working. And so in 893, he invites Arnulf of Germany, who's a Carolingian, to invade Italy and knock the Lombards of Spoleto down a peg. And in response, Lambert II, the emperor of Germany, and his regent, his dad, Lambert I, having recently died, is his mother, Adjeltrude, and they show up and they imprison Formosus in Castel Sant'Angelo, the prison you have for popes.
Who knew that the Spoletans would take it wrong, that he wanted to have Germans invade them?
Right, but eventually, sure enough, Arnulf does invade in 895. He had some business to take care of in Germany, and Formosus is busted out of prison, and so he crowns Arnulf the emperor instead of Lambert, and Arnulf gets ready to invade Spoleto, but suffers an immediate stroke. And I guess if you're trying to figure out who God wants to be emperor, one of them suffering a stroke while they're climbing up a hill in Spoleto is the sign that he's not the one.
Would certainly be taken as such. Yes.
Formosus then dies of, quote, unknown causes, and whether that's shock and outrage at Arnulf getting a stroke or something more intimate and personal.
Possibly got a sharp dagger-like stroke in the side, right, or something.
And so riots break out against the Spoletans because the rumor is they had Formosus whacked. They make Boniface VI the Pope, and he dies of gout after 15 days. And so the Spoletans come back to Rome and they make a guy named Stephen VI their Pope. And he's the Spoletans guy.
I think Boniface should not have eaten all of those capers at his investiture celebration.
I agree. He probably should also have stayed away from the delicious, delicious mushrooms that someone served him. But anyway, or perhaps the length of steel that someone served the mushrooms on.
Yes, the delicious almond paste.
Right. Mm. Oh, I can taste the ground glass in every bite of this gratinet. So good. As it were, though, Stephen VI is now Pope. And he's in charge, and the Spoletans are in charge of Rome. And so Stephen VI says, let's get one thing clear. We're going to dig up Formosus and put him on trial for being such a jerk to my patron, Queen Adjeltrude, the Dowager Empress.
Yes, this will help with the murder accusations against us.
And so he puts the corpse on trial for perjury, for transmigration of sees, the whole trying to become bishop of Bulgaria and then trying to become pope. And also, hey, you were excommunicated. How did you get to be a bishop again? That seems irregular. So they put a deacon in charge to act in Formosus' defense. The best job in Rome, I'm sure. But despite this guy, he's found guilty. Formosus is found guilty. So they strip off his papal robes from his corpse. They cut off his three fingers, the fingers that he makes the sign of the cross with, and then they bury him in a commoner's grave. And then they think, oh, no, 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 the people of Rome hate me, so they love Formosus, so they'll go make his grave a place of pilgrimage and worship. So we'll dig him back up, and we're going to throw him in the Tiber River, and that'll solve the problem. We're going to weight it down with chains, and that'll end our Formosus situation. But once again, God may not have wanted Arnulf to be emperor, but he certainly doesn't want Formosus treated that way. So the body washes back up, and the people are like, the body of Formosus is doing miracles. He must have been a saint. Let's riot against the Spoletans, who we hate anyway.
Yes. This is why I make it a policy never to throw the bodies of my enemies into a river, because what if they come back and start doing miracles? That's too costly.
Especially if you have murdered or possibly taken advantage of the sudden and convenient death of a pope. Don't throw the body in a river. That can't end well. So anyway, the people riot and they imprison Stephen VI and then get themselves all head up. And I guess Rome is hot in July. And so they strangle him in the prison, or he dies of gout, I guess, whatever. But Stephen VI is gone. So
still eating the capers. Stop eating capers, dark century popes.
They're so tasty. By December, we have a new pope. And I'm not sure if this is a new pope or just a new pope, but it's Pope Theodore II. And he annuls the cadaver synod. And he reburies the body with all honors. So everyone is cool now. No more nonsense. In 898, in fact, everyone is so cool that the Spoletan Pope, John IX, re-annuls the Cadaver Synod once in Rome, and he travels to Ravenna, where Lambert II is reigning, and says, we're going to have another synod to say, wasn't it a dumb idea to have a synod? And Lambert II has to sit there and take it.
Not to interrupt this narrative, but do we know why Pope Theodore II lasted a year? Was that more gout?
Well, in fairness, this is an era in which they're averaging one pope a year. I looked at Theodore II, but he's one of those with a little stub article, and it's like, what did he do? He ticked off the Byzantines, and he fought the Muslims, and then he died. And it's like, well, thanks a lot. That doesn't really help Theodore II. But he did, you know, he did the right thing. Anyway, I assume he was a little too non-Spoletan for the Spoletans, so maybe he walked into a door. Anyhow, the synod that John IX convenes not only says the Cadaver Synod is wrong, he says, we're also going to take the records of the Cadaver Synod, we're going to burn them. That's how wrong they are, which is why we don't have the records. And he's going to excommunicate the seven cardinals who sat at the synod. And then we're also going to make a new rule, no more trying corpses. That's embarrassing for everyone. And Emperor Lambert is sitting there and taking it. And I feel like the secret sauce is that the Emperor Lambert's cousin Guy has died between then and now. And his cousin Guy was the guy with the big army, and he was getting ready to invade Sicily, and he was a real problem for everybody. And he just suddenly and helpfully died. And that meant that Adeltrude, good old Empress Adeltrude, didn't have sort of a bad cop to turn to. She only had the good cop, Lambert. And so.
Right. So John IX was Spoleto backed, but the chill Spoletan.
Exactly. And he was also trying to probably get the people of Rome to stop rioting just one time, just any one time.
Hence the no more corpse trial policy.
So you'd think this is the end. This is the end of the Cadaver Synod, but a new guy, Theophylact of Tusculum, he's anti-Spoletan because he's from Tusculum, not from Spoleto, but he's gigantically corrupt. And he says, well, if I'm going to be gigantically corrupt, I should have my own pope. That's how it's done. And he puts Sergius III on as Pope, to which everyone, literally, including me, the time traveler, are saying, so? But he was one of the cardinals excommunicated by John IX. And so he's still big mad about the Cadaver Synod. And so he tries to get Formosus re-condemned, but he basically can't even get the Roman clergy to go along with it. So everyone who is appointed to anything by Formosus has to write, they have to reapply for their jobs, like a hostile takeover. And the Roman clergy are only going along with it under threat of imprisonment or big bribes from Theophylact. And if you're not in Rome, they just ignore the Pope. They say, we're not doing that. That's stupid. Go away. And sure enough, Sergius does not go away. He breaks the one Pope a year string. He reigns until 911, but he certainly is not able to get anyone to join him in his big mad against Formosus. And that is the end of the Cadaver Synod story. And a reason that we have it is there is a chronicler named Luprand of Cremona who is big mad at Sergius and thinks he's horribly corrupt, which fair enough. And so he says, oh yeah, Sergius is bringing up the story of the Cadaver Synod where all the records have disappeared. Let me write the worst possible version of this story to blackguard Sergius and Theophylact of Tusculum. And what the hell, the Spoletans too, because I'm just mad at everybody. I'm from Cremona. And so that's the version of the story that we have. But as far as, you know, we have the records of the other synod that says the Cadaver Synod is gone, don't try a corpse, which implies, at the very least, there was a corpse trial, and it was enraging to the Roman population and embarrassing for everyone involved.
So does our time stream, are we better off to have had the lesson of a corpse trial and the decision to not do that anymore, or is that something that you want to change?
There can be no less relevant thing to my personal idea of history than who is Pope in 897 AD. It is literally an empty spot, as we have hopefully demonstrated.
Are you saying that this segment was a slender thread onto which to hang a telling of the amazing Cadaver Synod story?
Cadaver Synod story, perhaps. If you are looking for second order bounces, then the guy to get rid of is Formosus, if what you're trying to do is kickstart an Italian kingdom early, because if they didn't have to keep rattling the Pope's cage, the Lombards of Spoleto, they were going to conquer Naples and that stretch from the Byzantines and then move on to Sicily. And if you have a papacy that can sort of take that and create a compact with the new kings of Italy instead of trying to drag some guy from Germany in to solve their problems all the time, then you maybe get Italian nationalism, or at least a break between Germany and Italy started. You avoid the Guelphs and the Ghibellines. You do a whole lot of other changes to medieval history. I'm not sure that it's worth it to do any of that. And certainly the question of the cadaver synod specifically has no historical bearing as far as I can tell, given that it's been reversed twice and no one cares. So yeah, I would say thin read. The alternate history that we're looking at is, what if Guy the Fourth of Spoleto lasts long enough to conquer Sicily? And the question of what is going on with Pope Formosus? I guess the other nexus point is Pope Nicholas says, sure, keep Formosus in Bulgaria. I'm just going to change the rule about no changing sees. And then Bulgaria goes Catholic instead of Orthodox. And that would be a big change. That would annoy the heck out of the Byzantines and would also probably change a good bit about the religious history of the Balkans. So that's another Formosus related time stream point, but you'll note none of it has to do with his cadaver synod. That is just a fun story to tell to annoy people who venerate the papacy a little too much, I guess.
Right. Well, in that case, you would be, as a side effect, eliminating the cadaver synod in order to change Bulgaria.
Right. Yeah, because he's off in Bulgaria, and whatever happens to his cadaver is at the hands of the Bulgarians, which does not mean it couldn't be gross. It's just going to be differently gross.
And a Catholic Bulgaria could have ripples even into like the 20th century and today, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. If Bulgaria is more oriented to the West, like Romania, then that really drops the hammer on Russia's expansion into the Balkans plan, because Bulgaria was always Russia's sort of stalking horse. And if Bulgaria instead is, you know, oriented towards France or Italy, that is a whole different geopolitical bag of worms.
If it has a solidarity movement in the 80s to go along with Poland, that
right.
could be a big deal.
That would be
and
a big also, deal.
And therefore Pope-related.
Exactly. And also, if the Bulgarians become the protectors of the Christian shrines in Constantinople instead of the Russians, that redirects the Russian, at least their ideological expansion, although they still probably want the Straits, but they don't even have the thin reed to hang it on that caused, among other things, the Crimean War. So, fun facts.
There we go. Stopping the Crimean War. There's a big geopolitical deal right there.
Exactly.
I knew if we scraped the wall hard enough, we would come up with something of note. And having done that, I think it's time for us to call yet another episode to a close, knowing that we will call one to an open a mere week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dark Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Keep this podcast not only above ground, but also alive, by conclaving with such backers as
Stephen Hammond,
Todd W. Olson,
Brian Malcolm,
Taylor Harless,
and Martin Rundquist.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindelaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.